This is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello folks, Ben here. Thanks for joining me for episode 33 of A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. If you're new to the podcast, welcome aboard. Where have you been? You've missed 32 amazing photographers talking about their work, their struggles, their practice, their lives, and their hopes and fears for the future. A couple more of you lovely people went over to iTunes and dropped off a review since the last episode. Thank you if you're one of those people. If you haven't done it yet, please take a minute to do it. Look, I don't know if it matters, to be honest. Like, who cares, right? But I guess in the end, the answer is that I do. This week, I chat with Magnum legend Chris Steele Perkins. Before all that, as is now the custom, I'm going to do a bit of photo news. Former Small Voice guest Edmund Clarke has a major exhibition which has now opened at the Imperial War Museum here in London. It's called The War of Terror. It's powerful stuff, extremely well put together. But just go and see it if you're in London. It's not just photography, it's kind of a mixed media affair, as I guess is now Ed's trademark. Look, I don't know what else to say. Check it out, it's really worth it. The finalists and shortlisted photographers for the Renaissance Photography Prize 2016 have been announced. The Renaissance Photography Prize is an international award that showcases outstanding photography from emerging and established photographers while raising funds to support young women with breast cancer. And the winners will be announced during the awards ceremony on the 7th of September at Getty Images Gallery in London, where there will also obviously be an exhibition of the finalists' work. If you want to check out who those finalists are, go to renaissancephotography.org. The recipient of the $5,000 2016 Inga Marath Award is Daniela Zalkman for her project Signs of Your Identity. Congratulations to her. That award, of course, jointly run by Magnum Photos, the Magnum Foundation and the Inga Marath Foundation. Google it if you want to check out the website and see who the finalists were and see some of their work. The Aaron Siskin Foundation has announced the recipients of the Individual Photographers Fellowship Grants. Details at aaronsiskin.org/recipients. That's a thing for American photographers, essentially. Grants are up to $10,000. Congratulations to those people. So what can you say about Chris Steele Perkins? He was born in Burma in 1947 to a Burmese mother and English father who brought him back to England when he was 2 years old. He published his first photo book, The Teds, in 1979, and shortly after that joined Magnum Photos after an invitation to apply from Joseph Kudelka. He subsequently travelled all over the world, covering most of the major global conflicts of the 80s and 90s, in between working extensively in his home country and producing a number of books of that work, along with those from Afghanistan and later from his wife's native country of Japan. He's won, to name but a few awards, the Oscar Barnett Prize, the Robert Capa Gold Medal, and a number of World Press Awards, and all that despite the fact that he doesn't really consider himself to be a photojournalist. I spoke to him at the Magnum offices here in London on the occasion of his birthday. Here's Chris. Happy birthday. Got any plans?
No, I sort of, except for getting past it as quickly as possible. No, it's just, you know, one of those days.
Yeah. Well, it's good to, thanks for doing it, especially on your birthday. I thought we'd start with kind of what's going on at the moment. I wanted to ask you about your new British project.
Yes, indeed. Well, the idea is kind of something that has been on my mind for a while, about an issue that I've addressed in different ways about sort of immigration and those whole issues of who we are, you know, British identity and all that stuff. I guess photographically I've been poking away at it for one way or another for most of my working life. And this sort of hysterical sort of tone that it's taken on in the last few years has been a bit poisonous, I think. And I've been sort of thinking ways to do it, and I didn't want to go to Calais, and, you know, there's lots of people doing very good work in these kind of places. And it occurred to me that probably in London, and maybe in New York, but London was probably the most likely, that people from everywhere in the world were living here. And this seemed sort of struck me as rather an extraordinary thing. You know, we've kind of almost gone a whole circle from Britain going out to the whole world to the whole world coming back to Britain. And London in particular, almost like a city-state within that framework. And I thought, well, it would be interesting to kind of find out who these people are, you know. And I sort of looked at things like the UN list of recognised states, and that seemed like a good starting point. And figured, you know, if I photograph families and I photograph them in their own homes, it would be more serious, you know, because it would be about a serious commitment to being here rather than a tourist coming through for 2 days or something like that. And it would more about, you could, it deals then more with the issues of identity as well, you know, and all the different reasons people have got for coming here. And it, obviously it's random. I'm not using X as a representative of Nigeria or something like that. Just whoever comes along and fits that broad thing of having a family. Two people, you know, they can be gay, they can be best friends, really, if that's their kind of family. Or there can be 15 of them if they want their second cousins who happen to be there as well. And it's been all those things. So I do a portrait of everybody, and it's kind of a bit stylized kind of portrait. And I do an interview. Again, mainly around the sort of who do they feel they are now, you know, what was their feelings about London and Britain and where do they want to end up, and their kids, what, you know, they're English or Londoners and so on and so on and so on. And there's no real answers, there's all different answers coming out of this. But the plan is indeed to try to photograph approximately 200 families from each of these sort of UN-recognized countries, and to work on trying to get a book, an exhibition, build a proper website that could be an interactive website that could, you know, schools could use, for example. I'm talking with big advertising agency Grey, some people work there, about putting some of these things together, you know, which could work so that, for, I mean, I'd love it to be a resource, for example, for schools. It would be a chance to talk about Ghana or do you know where El Salvador is, and here's a real person from there, you know, and so on. Which I think could be really interesting way to have it seen and used, as opposed to, which, and also the more classic ones of, you know, the exhibition. And they came up with an idea of a book which I really kind of liked, which was, it was an unfinished book. All the countries weren't there, but you could subscribe and get sent a print to put into the book as they kind of, as it moved towards the end.
Yeah, that's an innovative idea.
You know, which I really kind of, because one of the problems with going to publishers is they say, well, when is this going to be finished then? You say, I don't really know.
Yeah, of course. Well, at least you've got a defined endpoint, and that's when you've got someone from every country in the world, right? And then, but, you know, it's done. But that's no mean feat to actually complete that task.
Well, it's taken me 2.5 years so far, and I'm... what, two-thirds of the way through, right. I guess. So probably got another couple of years. Because at the moment, it's kind of funded on a shoestring. And, I mean, everything, any money I've got sort of goes into it. But I'm doing other work. You know, I can't dedicate all my time to doing this.
Yeah, of course. Obviously, this wasn't a thing that was directly about the referendum, but it happens to have come at a very sort of appropriate time in a way. But when you started the project, did you know that there was a referendum on the cards at that point, or was that all very coincidence, the whole Brexit thing?
The whole Brexit thing was, I mean, who could have believed that we'd vote leave.
Yeah. You know? Well, evidently quite a lot of people.
Yeah. But no, that was never even on my mind. I just didn't have the faintest idea. I mean, The Guardian did their piece, you know, they were going to do it anyhow. They were going to do it in September.
Uh-huh.
But they brought it forward for those obvious reasons, which is fine. So no, it was an idea that was out there, just happened to intersect. Mm. I mean, obviously, yes, I understood that it was it had a relationship to all these issues of migrants and immigration and asylum and so on and so on. But hopefully coming at it from, these are kind of ordinary people in ordinary homes in, mm. you know, they're normal, you know, in a way.
Yeah, and a reflection of the incredible cosmopolitan nature of London, you know, as one of the most, you know, diverse cities in the world. I guess, well, it could be called the new Londoners rather than the new British in a
well,
way.
Well, I'm in the process of changing the name to something like that, because
right.
that's effectively what it is.
Yeah.
And the other thing, you know, clearly is I'm part of it. You know, my mother's Burmese.
Hmm.
I came here when I was two. And I kind of feel, you know, I've done a photograph of me and my family as part of the book
right.
project, you know, the overall project. So it's kind of got a connection to me, which is kind of more literally physical than many another project.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've said in the past that you've always felt like a bit of an outsider. Is that still true?
Probably not so much as it used to be, you know. And maybe it's partly from living in London for so long, really. I still kind of, it is curious kind of going around the country to the, you know, the smaller towns and things. The sense that you get at being looked at and the question that you know has popped up in somebody's mind, they're never going to ask you, is, oh, where are you from, kind of thing. And still that idea that maybe I could be from here and actually isn't that strange.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, you've still got that little lingering thing which is out there, which unfortunately I think Brexit's going to fuel.
Absolutely. So when the result came out, what was your reaction?
Well, depression, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first one, isn't it?
It just felt like it was driven by all the wrong reasons, you know. Yes, we all know that the bureaucracy is kind of super heavy and overprotective and so on. But it was all sort of came from a negative drive rather than a positive drive. It felt to me, and I guess many others who came out the wrong side of the referendum. But, you know, it's done now.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, so we get on with it. And hopefully we can build it, you know, we don't have to go through shit because of it. You know, we got to respond and hopefully tackle some of the issues that are going to come up with the rise of the right. How far will they come? You know, we'll see. But hopefully their kind of heads will keep down a bit.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, we could talk at length on that that topic. But well, I'll move on because I want to talk about your work, obviously. But how did you initially go about finding your subjects for that project? What was your approach?
Well, to be honest, I mean, the project kicked off with a little collaboration I did with this guy called Kez Glazier, who's had a website called The New British. And he found a bunch of about eight people, you know, who were from various sort of conflict zones or, you know, difficult places. And, you know, asked me to kind of work to do some portraits with him on it. So I did that and I thought, well, either I leave this now and get on with something else, or if I want to continue with this idea, I need to do everybody, you know. And Kez wasn't particularly interested in carrying on with it, and I was, so I've kind of went on from there. And I mean, they literally have come from random conversations to going on websites, to community groups, local newspapers, etc., etc., and flyers in restaurants and libraries and stuff like that. It comes from all over, and including now The Guardian.
Yeah, I was going to say, because The Guardian ran it recently as a feature, and they're now sort of on board with, you can go on to a page there, and if you know someone from a particular place, you can come forward. So I imagine you get quite a lot of response from that.
Well, I'm busy responding to the responses from that. Yeah, no, it's been really good.
Yeah. Like you say, you did interviews, because I was going to ask you about whether, you know, the people's backstory is obviously pretty essential, but, you know, some photographers, you know, are more concerned with letting the images speak for themselves in some way. But it seems to me it's essential to this project that you have some context for these people and to hear that what their stories are.
Well, I've never sort of bought into the idea of the photograph speaking for itself.
No.
You know?
I was going to ask you, because
it's a kind of contradiction, essentially.
There are a lot of things which photography is really bad at, and I think, you know, that's where the words can help.
Well, I think Daumier, wasn't it? I think the painter who sort of said right early on in photography's history, you know, that it describes everything and explains nothing, and that remains true to this day. So I've very frequently worked with text, you know, either with a writer, as with the TEDs, you know, book, or doing it myself, like I'm doing now, essentially, doing interviews and using that kind of material. Because for a lot of the projects I work on, that's important. You know, I want you to know that this family is from Guatemala, you know, as opposed to the question that you're going to ask, where are they from?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the answer.
Sure.
You know.
I mean, you could put that in a caption and leave it at that. But as you say, there's perhaps a little more information to convey with it, with this type of project.
Yes. And so, you know, to me, that's crucial. And there are other types of projects where the removal of information is the point, that you're not telling them. You want the ambiguity of the imagery to be ambiguous and not too tied down to some specific location, event, or something like that.
What would be an example of that in your own stuff? Can you think of something?
Well, yeah, I mean, I did this book, Tokyo Love Hello.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of.
And okay, I put Shinjuku or something as a thing. But the whole idea behind that was to try to produce a book that was like a walk, so that you kind of, there was only one picture on one page. It's like you walked out in the morning, you saw that. You went into the building and you saw that. You turned left and you saw that. You went up those stairs and you saw that. And, you know, so it was and you didn't explain what it was that you were seeing, but you were seeing it. Because that was part of the experience that I felt about Tokyo, that you kind of understood what was going on, and at the same time you didn't, and you were, had that ambiguity about it. And I wanted to maintain that in the presentation of the work.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that potential for ambiguity is one of the great joys of photography. Isn't it? You know, it's something you can really play with endlessly.
I really do, but I think a lot of people don't understand it, and kind of make assumptions that are wrong about what photographs will do and the message that they'll carry and the understanding that you'll have of it. Hopefully, I do.
Yeah. Well, no, I've no doubt. And so what's your process, just briefly, these days with this project, for instance? Are you shooting digitally?
Oh, absolutely. I am.
You have been for a while, right?
Yeah, it's 10 years, something like that.
Right. Are you taking an assistant for this, or you just show up, me, myself, I?
No, I've got a main assistant, Chloe, but there's a few series of sort of volunteers who work with me. Who they're all on holiday right now, but
It's no good.
No, but basically, I mean, just physically, you know, because I have to drive everywhere to carry the stuff. I try to do it simply, but it's, you know, I've got to take lights with me and stuff like that.
Right, so you're lighting all these portraits?
Well, not always. I mean, the great thing about doing the summer stuff is you can do a lot of it with really with available light.
Mm.
And you can push your ISO with digital very well.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I'd like to kind of stylize the pictures a bit one way or the other, but I tend to do it by what's there rather than reconstructing something that is a bit sort of...
I mean, I really like the way you've achieved a sort of kind of uniformity and consistency with the way that just the way in which you've, you know, arranged people in the frame with this project, you know, because when you've got a group of people, it can be quite difficult, you know, and I just really like the way that you've brought the images together by doing that.
Well, I sort of look at it and I sometimes say to the people, you know, it's a little bit of a performance. You know, you're doing a performance, but you're not doing the one that you want to do, which is the one you always do for a portrait, grin at me. Mm. Sometimes, you know, there's pictures where I got them laughing, but it's because they're laughing. If
right.
you like, you know, that's what happened.
Yeah.
Rather than
yeah.
the sort of nervous laugh of somebody who's kind of being photographed and thinks that they ought to look this way or that way.
Yeah.
And it usually takes, it doesn't take very long, 10 minutes or something before they get... You can only grin for so long, you know, your muscles get tired.
So you work pretty quick.
Well, the whole process probably takes about 2 hours from between one and two. From, you know, this maybe taking hours of setting up in advance. But, yeah, from sort of ringing the doorbell to leaving, yeah, say 1.5 to 2 hours. Mm. And that involves doing the interview and... just having a cup of tea and, you know, because you, it's fascinating because you're obviously you're walking in a strange place with people that you've never met before and they're kind of maybe a bit nervous and who's this stranger, you know.
Yeah. And you've got to and try and put them at ease.
The blank looking husband is always a good one because they very often it's sort of the woman who's organized everything. And then you get there and this husband's sort of going, so what's this all about then, you know? So,
no, what you completely baffled by the whole thing.
You know, my wife told me to be here, so here I am.
That's all the information that he needed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you quite chatty? I imagine it's especially with these kind of families that, you know, they've got fascinating stories, so you can get into, you know, extended conversations. But also, I guess some people just get in there and get the job done and get out, and some people are quite talkative. I always find it difficult to concentrate on what I'm trying to do and chat at the same time. Where do you fall along that kind of spectrum?
I tell them sometimes I'm not going to talk to you very much.
Right.
You know, I do the interview at the end because I like to sort of pick up a few little things that they might drop, you know, in conversation. But rather than talk to them about it while I'm trying to get the dog to stay where it's meant to stay or something isn't very constructive, so I kind of leave the interview to the end and then I pack, you know, when the assistant's packing up I'm starting to do the interview. I mean, I don't not talk to them, but right. I tend to direct them rather than anything, you
right,
know, can you
okay.
go up, move over there, and the other thing is body language, you know, the stiffness, you know, when somebody's not comfortable and you've seen them before, but when they're chatting to you before, they were kind of like that and now they're like that.
Right.
And then you're trying to encourage them to go back to what they were like, that you feel is more who they are than the one that they keep kind of jerking into because you're taking the picture. So, you know, all of that stuff, and then the light happens and then something happens and then get into a little grouping and you think that's interesting. And so some of them are literally take, like, you know, you say, well, I'm going to change the memory card now, and then they start, and then you keep on shooting, you know, and that's sometimes the picture.
Right. So there's all these little kind of, this little bag of tricks that you kind of pull things out of to get what you need, I guess, as we all do.
Yeah, I mean, it's fairly simple, but again, and then the you mentioned it before, you know, the overall construction of the picture. And for me, you know, that's really important, that the dynamic, as it were, the visual dynamic of the picture works. Mm. I mean, I'm not interested in documentary photography that is simply of the record. It's kind of boring. Mm. Well, it's not kind of boring. It is boring. Mm. You know, you want some kind of interpretation, some thing that you add into it to make it, you know, a personal thing. I know that's uncool at the moment, you know, for certain schools of photography.
Well, it might be, but I don't think there's any doubt that you're right about that. Yeah, so you mentioned before you came to England at two with your father, but you were born in Burma.
Yeah, that's right.
And what was he doing? Was he in the services, in the forces?
He'd been in the military, yeah. And it was interesting when I read Orwell's Burmese Days, you know, when I was probably about 30, it was then that I understood kind of the relation and the complexities of the kind of relationship and the colonial mentality and so on and so on, that he lived with and was part of his life and part of the reason that I came to England, because my mother had children from a previous marriage. So they weren't my father's, so he was only prepared to take me to England because I was his son. Yeah, the others were not of interest to him at all. So he kind of left my mother there and came to England with me.
Because he wanted you to benefit from an English education or whatever.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And that must have been extremely heartbreaking for everyone, for your mother especially, and for you, not that you probably would remember much about it, but, you know, what kind of early memories do you have of your childhood?
Well, the thing is, I don't remember anything about Burma. I mean, no. It's a long story, I won't go into it, but, you know, I met up with my mother much later and the other brothers and sisters that I've got, you know, half-brothers and sisters. And I've talked through some of the things that I thought I remembered from Burma, and this had never happened.
Yeah,
because they were all older, so they could remember.
You were only two.
Yeah, it's only two.
So your earliest memories would certainly be of England. And then I think you started taking pictures at college, didn't you?
Essentially, I mean, you know, people had cameras and things, but I started working on a student newspaper, really, and that's what got me seriously interested in photography, as opposed to just kind of
messing about,
having a camera and snapping the odd picture.
Yeah. And what do you think it was about it that kind of captured your imagination or appealed to you?
Well, it was a good time to be interested in photography, because the big magazines, you know, the Sunday Times, the Observer, and then Time and Life was, you know, Parry Match, Stern, they were all doing these fantastically big photo essays. You know, you'd get 16 pages of McCullen in the Sunday Times with a Chivas Regal sort of advert in the middle or something, but, you know, you'd get that kind of thing on an almost weekly basis. So photography was kind of exciting, and, you know, this was his high-level work, easily accessible. And then there were a few magazines that you got. The most important for me was Creative Camera, which would be them presenting a different school of photography, essentially. But again, top-end stuff by, well, you know, people like Minor White, or, you know, I'd never heard of other than through that. And Jerry Uhlsman, you know, all kinds of different people. And so you had this sort of massive range of possibility that photography, you sort of realized it could be this and it could be that and it could, you know. And, you know, I was looking and thinking, well, these are people making a living from this. You know, it's not like a hobby. They can make a living from
right.
it. And that's really kind of what triggered me.
So what photographers, you know, made an early impact at that stage? Were there any in particular that sort of, you know, you were drawn to?
Well, McCullen and Tony Ray Jones, but and Bill Brandt.
Mm.
I mean, they were all sort of homegrown, so it's partly because of that. And they are all doing very different things with photography. Bresson, Eugene Smith. I didn't come across Frank till quite a bit later. And then people like Minor White and Ansel Adams. I mean, not my
genre.
Practice, but I admired what they did.
Yeah.
You know, and got and Edward Weston and got a lot out of it. So yeah, it's pretty eclectic base, but you know, what I do practically is different. But I still very much enjoy photography for what it is in its broadest sense. I mean, I go every year to the wildlife photography show at the Natural History Museum. I make sure I go there. I think it's brilliant. Mm. You know, I could never wait that long for a nightingale jar to do whatever, you know.
But you can still appreciate it even though it's not your bag.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I guess your first big project was Ted's, which became a book about teddy boys. So it seems almost a quaint notion now, and they don't seem, you know, I look at those pictures and they seem incredibly unthreatening. But I guess maybe the reality was a bit different, you know. Were they quite intimidating, those guys? Because they look kind of friendly. They look like you could just give them a cuddle, really.
You know, like with most things, you know, the sort of mythology and the reality is kind of generally pretty opposite to what they are. Yeah, they were regular guys, mainly working class guys, obviously. But they were the ones I'd kind of grown up with. You know, this is the second generation, Ted. And yeah, there was a few sort of dodgy moments when you felt, you know, but like most things, somebody kind of wants to batter you and somebody says, leave it alone, you know.
Right, yeah.
And then after I, you know, became the guy they knew as the photographer.
Mm.
So that was it.
Yeah, it was a sort of little, it was kind of a fashion subculture and a music subculture, but it wasn't, you know, I think the mythology at the time was that, you know, they were kind of dodgy and there was that kind of undertow of violence and stuff. And yeah, like you
said. Well, it's like, you know, all of these movements, you know, the punks had the same thing, you know, that, and look at them now, you know, it's... I mean, there's stuff in the book. You know, there's a knife fight. There's a guy with a knife. I didn't even know he had a knife in his hand when I took the picture. Then I see this blade there. I think, oh, hang on. So there was stuff happening, you know, which wasn't great. And I've kept some of it in.
Mm.
And the book's actually being reprinted.
Right.
By Dowie.
Dowie Lewis?
Yeah, it went out of print, and I've redesigned it with a different cover and a larger format.
Mm.
It's essentially the same. But it's kind of being relaunched in September.
Great. That's fantastic. Look forward to that. And it came, I think it came from just a job, wasn't it? It was like a quick, you know, job that you'd been... Have you found that sometimes these big projects do come out of, you know, the most kind of unlikely beginnings?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, you've got to have your antennae out for whatever comes along and be really open. I mean, yeah, it was literally a one-day job. I went work with a friend of mine who is a writer, and we both kind of came out of the day and thought, that's weird. You know, we got to do some more on this.
Yeah.
And so we, you know, we worked together on it.
Mm.
But very much in parallel, you know, rather than him writing for me or me illustrating him. It was two pieces of work in
the
in
collaboration,
one book,
yeah.
Which is how I've liked to work, you know, with people. And so again, a few years down the line, the book kind of is ready.
Mm.
But yeah, I really think people should... You just don't know where something's going to take you. And there's been other stuff that I've done, which not necessarily resulted in a book, but it results in sort of a body of work.
Yeah. So how did you come to apply for Magnum? I think Joseph Kudelka was sort of instrumental, wasn't he, in that process?
Yeah, well, I'd been working in London, essentially, with the TEDs and then there was also with survival programs, with the Exit Group. And I met Joseph a few times. He used to stay on the floor with a friend of mine, Paul Trevor, who was involved in the exit group. And we met a few times and chatted and showed him some work and so on. And he called me up one day and said, you know, why don't you make an application for Magnum? And it seemed like it was the right time for me as well, because the exit group and Ted's, it had all been about Britain. And I was getting interested in traveling and thinking I needed an agency and things like that if I was going to do that kind of work. So it all panned out, you know,
beautifully. Well, yeah. Was it? Did it seem like a huge kind of deal for your career at that stage when you first got in?
Yes. I mean, you know, I understood, obviously, that there was what Magnum meant, as it were, in the photographic firmament.
Yeah.
And particularly for what I wanted to do, which was then do a lot of traveling and just explore the world. And if I was going to have an agency, then it would, the preferred agency would be Magnum.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know.
So were there any particular Magnum photographers at the time who sort of took you under their wing and mentored you and, you know, people that you learnt from?
Well, you know, Joseph, you know, at the beginning, René Bure, he used to be around the Paris office a lot. And right at, when I joined, there was no London office, so Paris was my office. So René and Bruno Barbe, you know, you used to have these sessions. You'd come back from somewhere, you know, and there's all slides in those days, and you'd put them all out in the light box, and René would come along and say, no good, no good, no good, and then that's good, okay, maybe, you know. And that was all kind of pretty instructive.
Yeah, steep learning curve. And then you ultimately, you became president yourself for several years. What possessed you to take on that responsibility? How did that
happen? Well, the thing is, with Magnum presidents, you know, most organizations, there's a few people compete for the job. In Magnum, you kind of get kicked there.
You compete to try and avoid
it. Yeah. I mean, it's a thankless task. It's probably all right now because things have moved in a different direction, but it was a curious time.
But in a way, it was kind of a golden era, would you say?
Well, in terms of, you know, photojournalism, it was a good time to be a photojournalist. There's undoubtedly that, you know, to be embroiled in the politics of Magnum wasn't necessarily a particularly good time. But, yeah, I mean, like I said, those sort of key magazines were there, and a lot of magazines you'll never heard of, which had big budgets, you know, and would send you off to South Africa for 2 weeks and pay all the expenses and give you the rights to use them anywhere else. You know, fantastic.
Yeah, so you could really earn a decent living. But how has it changed, do you think, you know, to accommodate these kind of huge changes that have taken place in photography? What are the main kind of things that the agency has had to do to accommodate those changes?
There's a very long answer to that one. I won't give you that one.
No, but I can imagine. Yeah, we could talk about that for a long time. Yeah, give me the short version.
I mean, the shortest, big, you know, the biggest single change has obviously been the whole digital revolution. But the consequence of it, that there's an awful lot of material out there that's being sold for very little money, and people like Corbis and Getty were involved in trying to drive prices down to literally buy out the opposition and monopolize the marketplace. So maintaining a viable income when the bottom had fallen out of the market, because 50%, for example, of all Magnum sales around the time I was president were from the archive. And that was like the engine that I could go anywhere. I said, I don't have to worry about it. I know I'm going to get this money from the archive sales of my work.
Yeah, you get it eventually.
So I literally didn't think about, you know, how much is this job going to cost me or something like that. Just didn't bother about that. So readjusting to the new marketplace when, you know, if you can get £2,000 for a story sold to a magazine in Britain, you're lucky.
Mm.
And it will have cost you three or four.
Yeah.
You know. So, and we're still adjusting to it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're beginning to do other things, you know, which is, well, things like the square print sale, for example. I don't know how long it'll last, but it's very popular. And it allows all of Magnum photographers, as opposed to an elite group who kind of get the key jobs, to participate in a sale of work that they stand by directly to the public.
Mm.
I think it's really kind of a positive step. And we couldn't have done something like that prior to the digital sort of revolution.
Yeah, absolutely.
As it were. So there's swings and roundabouts.
Yeah, some revenue streams have fallen away, and then new ones are hopefully kind of come
building
about.
Up.
And there's more. And there seems to be many more photographers now than there ever was. But so there's more kind of mouths to feed, as it were. But have the criteria for getting in changed as well? Because it seems like there's a broader base of styles and approaches now than there ever used to be.
I think that's developed. I mean, I think that's developed inevitably in the development of photography per se.
Yeah.
You know, we only ever, I feel, reflected, you know, photography, which was about a broadly sort of documentary tradition, inverted commas, humanitarian stroke documentary position. And I think that remains true. That people working in that tradition, however, have kind of pushed it to different levels, different places.
Mm.
And I think hope we're trying to sort of do what we've always tried to do, which is bring the best people in who are kind of pushing the boundaries, but really still making interesting imagery.
Yeah.
Because that is key. You know, you can push boundaries and get, as we've said before, pretty boring. Or you can do it in an interesting way.
Mm.
And, and we've still got places to go, I think, you know, on the gender front and on the ethnic front.
Mm.
And hopefully over the next few years, we will address those issues more than we have done
right.
in the past.
So, in those early days, what made you want to go abroad and you know, explore those kind of avenues? You know, was photography in a way an excuse for travel, or because you started off, you know, like you say, shooting here?
Yeah, no. Well, I can mark it very clearly. I on the Exit project, I went to Belfast, and for me, that was really a shock. I mean, it was abroad. I mean, to
yeah,
me.
Close enough, yeah.
And also there was a, you know, civil war going on there at the time. So it was really different from what, you know, okay, there were links that you could make, race riots and issues, you know, that were taking place in the 70s in mainland Britain too. But, you know, it was a step up, as it were, in terms of conflict. So I guess at that time I started thinking I'd be really interested in go beyond this, you know, and I got interested in conflict zones. Again, partly out of just being young and stupid, and also a consciousness that I was living a privileged life, you know, that had I been born in any other period of European history, I'd been in some kind of a war,
yeah.
you know, or the other.
That's a good point.
You know, whether it's with Napoleon or, you know, whoever, internally,
Hitler.
Externally.
Yeah.
yeah. So, yeah, and that's really kind of what triggered it.
So Northern Ireland was your first experience of violent conflict, essentially.
At a sort of war level,
yeah.
as it were.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so, I mean, how did you react to it initially? Was it that you thought, okay, I can kind of see that I might be able to be able to work in these kind of circumstances and still produce good images? You know, whether you were kind of, I guess, you know, you were cut out for it, as it were.
Both. Mm. Yeah, I mean, you wanted to know whether you could stand it, as a way, you know, without getting killed.
Yeah.
You know, in a rather sort of stupid macho kind of way. And yes, you obviously wanted to know if you could deliver.
Mm, of course.
You know, work that would be up there with the people whose work you admired.
Mm. And that's a real challenge, right?
So, I mean, yeah. But I mean, also Magnum's kind of part of that challenge. You know, once you're in Magnum, you're a sort of across the board being challenged by, you know, what X and Y is doing and what you're doing. And
so there's a certain amount of peer pressure in a way. You feel like you've got to, you know, like you say, rise to the to that
up
level.
To the point. But there wasn't any peer pressure to go to a
no, I mean, from yourself
zone,
in a way. Yeah,
yeah, you felt you had to kind of keep a standard up and then try to push it on.
Because it's funny, you know, I in a way I didn't think of you as a conflict guy. You know, I think about, you know, the Tokyo book and the TEDs, obviously, and all kinds of things come to mind. And then, you know, when I started looking back on the World Press books and all that, I was thinking, oh wow, Chris still fucking took that picture, you know, all these different stories that are in kind of very much in my consciousness, and realized that you'd done them and you've been everywhere and you've been to a lot of those places. I know you went to Somalia in the early 90s. Which of those conflicts has, you know, had the most powerful kind of emotional impact on you? Was it Somalia?
No, I thought it was Somalia until I went to Rwanda.
Right.
But, well, it wasn't really Rwanda. It was as it was then, Zaire.
Mm.
But it was Rwandan refugees coming through into Zaire. And that was the kind of...
So was this the Tutsi Hutu genocide in the mid-90s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was the sort of aftermath of that. And that's when I thought, you know, this is kind of, to use the cliche, this really is sort of hell on earth.
Mm.
So probably emotionally that, and most importantly was Afghanistan, where I decided I was going to stop it all.
So that was the point at which you'd had enough, kind of thing.
Yeah. No, I had a very clear moment when I thought, okay, if I get out of this, this is it.
What was that moment?
Well, it was being, you know, basically I'd gone in with the Taliban had taken Kabul by this time, and they were pushing up into the Panjshir Valley, which is where Massoud, the kind of at that time very famous sort of leader of a section of the Afghan population, they were kind of challenging them north of Kabul. And I was with Massoud's troops, and they got circled, and I could see it happening. And I was saying to them, look, guys, these guys are coming around here, you know.
Mm.
And then they started to pack up and run. And I packed up and ran too.
Mm.
And see, I was with Jim Nakdwe, and there was a couple of other photographers. And you're being fired at, and you see the stuff going up in the air where it's missed you, and you think, well, this next one's going to hit me. And, you know, RPG landed just near us, and we hit the ground, and it didn't go off. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. And that was a very clear moment. I thought, I got two kids.
Mm. So sort of, you know, your kind of instinctive self-preservation kicked in. But a lot of those guys, they just keep going back to it. And I think, you know, maybe there's something that they haven't quite got that, or there's something else that drives them to keep.
Well, there is other stuff that drives people. I mean, I don't have it myself, but, you know, I mean, yes, Don keeps on doing it, and, you know, others like Tim, you know, who died for it. But yeah,
Tim Hetherington.
Yeah. So you each to their own.
Yeah.
You know, for me, that was clear. I mean, I was just being stupid by being there. You know, you kind of get a thrill out of it, but yeah, it's stupid.
Hmm. Also, you know, as you say, you were with James Nachtwey, so you have that question of, well, we're all taking the same pictures, we're all in the same situation, like, what's the point, you know, what are we really achieving?
You know, exactly. I mean, that, you know, is a big question, obviously, with any of the sort of event photography, I suppose, you know, that it's so well covered by so many people, that is your stuff really going to make a difference or stand out in any way?
Yeah. So how do you manage to balance the sort of inevitable emotional impact with the need to just get on with the job and produce, you know, strong images?
Well, I think that's kind of professionalism, basically. You know, it's the doctors have to do the same, you know, the nurses have to do the same, the soldiers have to do the same.
Yeah.
You've got to do the same.
But yeah, I mean, I don't think you really thought of yourself or think of yourself as a photojournalist. Is that right?
I mean, I have had one foot in that camp, you know, for a certain series of works that I've done, but to me it's been part of a larger process of me just looking at the world. I mean, I see myself as a documentary photographer, inverted commas, but not really as a photojournalist. I can work as one and have, but I've also can work, do other types of work, which I'm perfectly happy to do.
In terms of books, I mean, of all the books you've done, is there any one particular book that you're particularly proud of or that you're particularly pleased with?
Well, you know, they could all be better when you go back to them. I mean, The Tense is obviously important to me because it was the first book that I did and the first one that I felt like obviously had my signature on it. I like Fuji partly because it's pretty different from the rest of the stuff that I've done.
That's your book on Japan?
Well,
on Mount Fuji.
No, it is on Japan, yeah. I mean, rather than it's on Fuji. And I actually think the book I did on Afghanistan is not bad. But, you know, there's a few more left in me yet.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there is. I'm thinking about whether, you know, how you think about whether it's a good time now for photographers and bookmaking in the sense that, you know, there seem to be more options available for people who want to make books now. Do you think it's a good time to be making photo books? Or do you think, as some people do, that there are too many photo books out there?
Well, this is the big question. I mean, it's really hard to keep up, you know, with, I mean, when I did the TEDs, I'm guessing here, but there was maybe 20 photo books printed that year in the UK.
Wow.
I might be exaggerating the numbers. So you kind of knew what was going on and who was doing what and so on and so on. But the numbers now, you know, when I sort of wander around Parry Photo and look at the book, and that's just, you know, the top of the iceberg. It's difficult to get noticed and picked, you know, in the amount. I suppose it's wonderful for people. They've kind of got this way of putting it out there, but who gets to see it in the end? And yeah, it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about A Place in the Country. That was, I think, probably your last one that you did. Story about, or a project on, kind of stately home here in the UK. I think you've always been fascinated by, you know, this place, your own country, as well as spending half a lifetime all over the world.
Well, the other half has been spent
here. Yeah. So you've kind of kept that little balance between shooting here in the UK and also going off. And it seems to have been an important thing for you.
It is. As I said before, you know, that sort of thing about Englishness, and, you know, identity and so on and so on. it's always been nagging away at me in one way or the other. And I've had in the back of my mind for a long time this idea that I wanted to do something about the English country house, and, you know, and there wasn't much there. You know, there was a few pictures that Tony Ray Jones or Bill Brandt had taken, but nobody had done a sort of
a whole project,
a whole project, as far as I knew, anyhow. And there was actually one of the guys who was working here. We got talking, and he was sort of, I threw that idea in, you know, up, and he sort of got hold of it and said, "Oh, you should really give that a go," and so on and so on. And then he actually put me in touch with the Historic Houses Association, and sort of through a whole process, I got in touch with Holcomb, and I said, "Look, I just want to be, if you like, the artist in residence. You leave me alone, and I'll make a record of this place." And he was great, Tom Cook, and he did as he promised. And, you know, I came up and went down and came up and went down. And the whole idea was to do
this a year. This was the Lord of the Manor, as it were.
Yes. So, yeah.
So it was a little glimpse into a hidden world.
It was, you know, because I think I put it in the introduction, you know, you drive around, and you sort of see these walls, you know, and going on forever, and you think, what's going on behind there?
It's that essential curiosity that I think photographers have about, you know, what, like you say, yeah, what if I stick my nose into that? What would I find?
And also, you know, the country house in terms of British culture, you know, you can't read a novel set in Britain which isn't partly in a country house, and you can't see a film that isn't partly in a country house. Yeah. So it has this enormous resonance at one level. I was just kind of curious.
Mm.
And Tom was open enough to kind of...
Yeah, to let you in.
Accommodate that.
Yeah. I can't talk to you without trying to kind of get a few tips out of you, really, you know, for out of things that you've... perhaps learnings that you've made over a long career. So, like, if you know, if young photographers ask you for advice, what are the things that you tend to say? I know that's a very broad question, but I'm going to leave it broad on purpose.
No, I mean, I think, you know, the things I tend to say tend to be fairly banal, but they're kind of fairly fundamental, I think. You know, I don't have the magic solution. Nobody does, and if they tell you they've got it, they're lying, you know. But I think a lot of people come to photography because it's easy, and it is, you know, at the first level. It's very easy to take something that looks quite nice and so on and so on. But, you know, if they want to get any good at it, they're going to have to work really hard.
Mm.
And I think a lot of young photographers don't appreciate that. You know, they think, yeah, here's a short track to being, you know, being cool. And so, I mean, that's a simple thing to say, but it means a lot. You know, the best way to become a photographer, in my view, is to be a photographer.
Yeah.
Is to take pictures.
Yeah.
And then to be your own worst critic. Well, best critic, I suppose, in the end, but, you know, the severest critic. And, you know, educate yourself not simply about photography, but about how pictures are made. You know, go look at Rubens, you know, look how he composes the tableaus, you know, big influence on me. And look at film, you know, get in the world to live, you know. Yeah. And you know, that's all more important than anything else.
And I think everything you just said is completely true, and more so than ever probably, because it's the vast amount of images that are being produced to no particular end means, I guess, that if you're going to be a photographer, you have to then work even harder to differentiate yourself from those people who, you know, you can take a really good shot with your iPhone and, you know, put it on Instagram, but what does it actually mean?
Well, you know, I think the idea of sort of trying to develop a voice, you know, a personal voice in photography is what is going to get you recognition. And, you know, photography is kind of quite limited in that respect. You know, you kind of, well, documentary photography, because you've essentially got what's in front of you to deal with. Okay, you've got a few people now reconstructing things and developing them. But it's, you know, unlike painting where you can almost go anywhere with the image, you've kind of got to deal as a documentary photographer with what's in front of you. So the choice of what you choose to shoot and the way that you choose to shoot it and the skills that you bring to that process are crucial. And they kind of build up with the accretion of time and experience. And I can't list them to you, you know, but if you don't do the work, you never get there, basically.
Yeah, do the work. I think that's quite often what it all comes down to.
I know, it's kind of simple, but it's been a simple truth for a long time. And it doesn't, you know, I often, with workshops, you know, you talk sport. I mean, you want to be a run, you know, you can run, you can jog, or you want to do the marathon and win it. What, you know, where are you standing in that line? And if you want to get around, well, that's pretty good. You know, you don't have to be ashamed of that. But, you know, winning it
is another ball game. Yeah. And you know, are you still as passionate as ever, or is that something one has to actually, you know, work to maintain when you've been taking pictures for a very long time?
Well, I consider myself really fortunate. I mean, I'm not so keen on doing certain types of things that I'm, you know, conflict is one that at one time I used to be interested in doing. But working as a photographer, I mean, I feel that you do the work that's appropriate to who you are as a human being at whatever time in your life. I mean, Springsteen said about his songwriting, you write to your age and your experience. And yeah, I mean, there's a whole library of stuff up here that I want to do.
Yeah.
But I need to kind of get through what I'm doing right now, you know. So I haven't run out of ideas, not at all.
Great.
Fortunately.
No, well, good to know. Well, many, many thanks for talking. It was great to meet you. I shall look forward to the Londoners project when it comes to fruition. And I look forward to the reprint of Ted's. And happy birthday again.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thanks, Chris.